The scripture reading this morning is Job chapter 38, verses 1 through 7. Job chapter 38, verses 1 through 7. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you will make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?"
Good morning. Going to continue in Job today, and we'll be looking at the last portion of the book, having kind of moved through it rather hurriedly in the middle portions. We'll be in particular looking at chapter 38 with a short pit stop in the chapters just previous to it, because there's a guy I want to talk about that never gets talked about, and I want to. The title for today's sermon is "The Ignorance of a Righteous Man." We've heard about the complaint of a righteous man. We've heard about the misery of a righteous man, and today we're going to learn that Job, as fine a fella as he is, it turns out, doesn't know everything. And that's an important lesson, because in a room full of people like this, I see a lot of pretty good people, right? I mean, by and large, in a church, you have people that are trying to do good things with their lives and trying to make good decisions. I imagine none of you committed any major crimes this morning on the way here. Don't prove me wrong on that, but just saying, you know, as a general rule, pretty good folks. Does that mean you understand everything that's going on in the universe? Sometimes we fool ourselves into thinking, I'm a pretty good person, I got things figured out, and so I'll tell you how it is. And the book of Job is a powerful reminder that as fine a person as you might be, you're still you, and God is still God, and that's not the same. And Job has to be reminded of that towards the end. What does Job want? Throughout the middle section of the book, Job has had one basic request. It's said a half dozen ways, but one basic thing he wants. He's suffered, and he's pretty sure, just like his three friends, that righteous people aren't supposed to suffer, and wicked people are. He doesn't believe he's a wicked person, at least not that wicked. And so what he thinks is there must be some kind of clerical error in heaven. Somehow in the courtroom process of heaven, however God decides who suffers and who gets blessed, some mistake was made, because he believes God's a good God, but he also believes he's a pretty good person. And so something has gone wrong here, and what he asked for is an audience with God. Over and over and over again, while he's arguing with his three friends who don't get anything right, he says, if I had a chance, I could go to God and explain things, and everything would be better, because God's fair and just, and I know he'd hear me out. So he says it like this in Job 31. This is his very last chapter of speech in Job 35 through 37. He says, "Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me as a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him." What does he want? He says, "I wish they'd give me the court documents. Give me the transcript. I apparently was tried and found guilty, and I never even got to face my accuser. I don't know what I'm supposed to have done to deserve all this. If they would just give me the documents, have an angel bring it down, whoever the clerk is in heaven, have him bring down the documents with the indictment on it, and I'll wear it proudly. If I'm guilty, I'll say I'm guilty. If I'm innocent, as I'm pretty sure I am, I'd make my appeal, and I know God would hear me. I'd come to God like a prince." And this is where things start to get sideways, if they hadn't already. That what he seems to be saying is, I don't think God is bad, but something went wrong on his part, or I wouldn't be in this mess. At this point, Job stops speaking, as do his three friends. No more from them. The next speech that you get is from Elihu, who is the most overlooked and wonderful character in the book of Job. I love Elihu. I considered tossing my sermon out and just preaching on Elihu today, because he's a fantastic figure. He was a role model for me as a young man, because he's a youngster. Okay, Elihu is the young guy in the group, and so he doesn't say anything for 31 chapters. He just sits there and bites his tongue till it bleeds and listens to everything that's said. And then finally, when everybody's had their say and nobody's getting anywhere, in chapter 32, he says, "All right, is everybody done? I waited my turn." And he's very respectful in that sense. He's blunt from that point forward. He says, "All of you are wrong about everything." But he is very respectful in the sense that you are older men. I'm going to let you have your say and speak before I take my turn. So in chapter 32, he says, "All right, it's now my turn. And I think there are some things that need to be said." And what I think happens is God uses Elihu to answer Job's questions. When we get to the section we're going to get to today in chapter 38, God doesn't answer any of Job's questions. And there's a reason for that. We'll get to it in just a moment. Instead, what I think he does is he allows this young man Elihu to kind of be his spokesman. And he goes in and makes a case, and he says some things that just haven't been said yet. You'd think everything that could be said about suffering had been said in the first 31 chapters, and they haven't. There are some things that have been overlooked, and Elihu says them. In chapter 33, he says, "You have forgotten that suffering can be a teacher. You can learn from pain." That's a huge idea. I don't know if that has been said anywhere in this book at all. So far, everyone has said, only wicked people suffer, so you must have done something wrong. Suffering is bad. What does Elihu say? Maybe. But what if God used suffering to teach you? Could there be a scenario where suffering made someone better? Now, that's a hard pill to swallow. Don't get me wrong. It's a very challenging idea. But when you get to the idea of Jesus in the New Testament, it's actually essential. The book of Hebrews says he was made perfect by the things that he suffered. Suffering does not make you less. And chapter 33 is dedicated to that concept. Chapter 34, he vindicates God. He says, "Job, you don't need to talk to God." First of all, by the way, he uses my favorite line in the book of Job, of which there are lots of great lines. In Job 33 and verse 6, he says, "Job, you want to talk to somebody? I too was pinched off from a block of clay." He says, I'm just a mud person just like you. I was made out of clay just like you and Adam and everybody, right? I'm one of you, so you don't have to be afraid of me. Just listen to me. I too was pinched off from a lump of clay, just like you were, Job. But let me tell you, he says, God is just, and so you don't need to file an appeal. Job's whole idea has been that there must have been some kind of mistake up in heaven. Somebody made a clerical error, and we just need to sort this out. And Elihu says, there are no mistakes in heaven. You may not understand what's going on, but the correct answer isn't, let's fix God. That can't be the right answer. You don't need an appeals court. Furthermore, even if you wanted to file an appeal, chapter 35 says you have no rights before God. Job actually sounded very American in that last bit. In chapter 31, where he says, "You know, I want the right to face my accuser. I have that right, don't I?" Americans love to talk about rights. These are my rights. This is what I get. Job says, I have the right to face my accuser. Elihu says, not if it's God. If it's God, what right do you have? You don't have any right. He made you. If he wants to give you a blessing, if he wants to give you a privilege, if he wants to treat you a certain way, that's entirely up to him. But nobody gets to go to God and say, based on the divine constitution, you owe me the following rights. Nobody gets to do that. You know why he says, you got to remember that that's the situation here. You come to God hat in hand. You don't get to come to God and say, this is the way it's going to be, Lord. And what did Job say? I would go to him like a prince. I'd go in there and tell him what he needs to know. Elihu says, that's not the way it works with God. In chapter 36, he says, and above all, there's one thing you absolutely don't get to say. Don't say God is wrong. You can say, I don't understand. You can say, I don't like it. You can say, I am utterly and completely confused and frustrated out of my mind. But what you don't get to say is God messed up. He says, that's not one of the options on the table, Job. And you need to make sure that you haven't said that. Finally, in chapter 37, Elihu says, basically, even if God explained everything to you, Job, I'm not sure you'd understand it. which is what leads us to God's conversation, which is today's sermon, beginning in chapter 38. This is where God finally interrupts the conversation. Elihu has actually responded to some of Job's direct concerns. God does not. Why not? I think there's an important reason. Because the whole point of God's response is, he doesn't have to respond to your questions like that. You see, when a child, and this is going to sound really awful, but just stick with me a second. When a child throws a fit, a temper tantrum, and you give them what they ask for, you have taught the child that you're actually in charge of me. You have this power over me. If you throw a tantrum, I'll get you to hush by doing whatever it is you want. You are in control. So as painful as it is, you can't cave to a temper tantrum. Okay? Job, I don't like to compare Job to a child throwing a tantrum because he has had a miserable day. Please understand. His situation is infinitely worse than any child's temper tantrum. But God responds in a similar way. He essentially says that God cannot come down every time a human says, well, that's not fair. God doesn't hop on his chariot and come down from the sky and say, oh, they're there. Let me tell you what's going on. Why? Because he's not you. He's him. He's God. And so even if he explains things to Job, he set a precedent that when Ben has a bad day, if I throw a fit and God is just and he took the time to go talk to Job, he better come talk to me. And so he doesn't do that. Instead, the way I think he handles it is he says, all right, kind of hands off, here's Elihu. Elihu's going to go answer your questions because God really does want us to understand. He doesn't want to treat us badly. He wants us to not be confused. He says, here's Elihu saying some things that need to be said. But then in chapter 38, in comes God, and God is not answering questions. Because God is God. God is here to ask the questions. That's his role. All throughout Job, God has been the one asking the questions. Satan comes up to God, and God says, whence comest thou? Where have you been? And then Satan gives a catty answer, and God says, have you considered my servant Job? See the point? God asks the questions. God makes the summons. God makes the demands, not us. And so in chapter 38, that's where he picks up. Number one, in chapter 38, if you'll turn to 38, we're going to be there kind of verse by verse for about seven verses. Chapter 38, verse 1, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, I've hinted at this already in the sermon series, but let me hit it again because I think this is enormously important. I don't believe God picks a whirlwind just because it's impressive. In the first chapter of Job, Job's children die because the wind came from the east and picked up the four corners of the house and crushed them. They were crushed by the force of a whirlwind. And that is the form that God decides to take. That means something. Could God have appeared as a pillar of fire? Yeah, he does in the Bible. That's a thing he does. Could he have appeared as a heavenly dove saying, there, Job, let's talk about this. He could have. He appears as exactly the form of the force that brought about Job's greatest misery, the death of his children. Why do that? Because God is God, and I am me. And what that means is, lesson number one, God is God, and he relinquishes his role to no one. God does not come to Job and say, well, actually, it was somebody else's fault. By the way, this is what we do, right? When you're in trouble with somebody, you go and you try to explain how it's Bill's fault, right? I didn't do that. It was somebody else's fault. Really, it's not my responsibility, okay? God doesn't do that. If you're in trouble at work, who do you try to blame? Somebody a different rung of the ladder, right? If you can pass it up, that's even better. I'm just doing what my boss told me to do. Is there anybody that God can pass the blame to? He can pass it down. but then he's not really in control of the universe, is he? If a good manager blames his subordinates, what does that mean? It means he's apparently not a very good manager, because he's supposed to be responsible for what they do. The only person a good manager can blame is someone higher up. I'm doing what I was told to do, and it's a bad idea. But I did it, and I did it well, and it didn't work. God now appears to Job, and he doesn't say, Satan made me do it. Because, folks, if Satan can make God do anything, we ought to be worshiping Satan. Apparently, he's the one in charge. And, of course, that's absurd. God takes full responsibility. You want to talk to the whirlwind, then you talk to God. It's painful, it's awful, it's ugly, it's not something we want to think about. But he says, if you want to talk to the person responsible for everything that happens in this creation, you speak to the Creator. The buck stops here. He takes complete responsibility. Could he blame someone else? Well, we read the first couple of chapters. I mean, Satan's a mess. We want him to blame Satan. But God says, that's not how we're going to do it. I appear to you. I'm not going to even... God could bring out Satan and say, aha, here's the person you need to ask your questions to. But again, that's passing the buck. As in the form of a whirlwind, God reminds us that God is God and that he relinquishes his role to no one. He is big enough to be blamed for the problems of his creation. If there's something wrong in this world, Job is right about this one point. The person you take it up with is God. Nobody else. Go right to the top. So that's how God appears. In the form of this whirlwind, the very object of Job's misery, he appears. And these are his words, beginning in verse 2. Guess what? We're going to start out with a question. And the questions don't stop for the next three chapters. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? What's his point here? Job, you seem to be talking a lot. But your, as the old preachers used to say, your knowledge exceeds your intellect. You seem to have a lot more words than you have understanding. Job, you have a lot to say, but you don't know what's going on. Why is that? Is it because he's a wicked man? Nope. God says he's a very good man. Is it because he is a particularly foolish man? I don't believe that either, actually. I think the only word you need is because he's a man. Because he's human and he's not God, it means there are simply limitations of what Job can and cannot know and understand. There are limitations. Parents and children understand this. Again, I keep going back to this metaphor because it helps me. There are times when I painstakingly explain things to my children because I want them to make good decisions when they grow up. There are other times when I don't have 3 hours for a lecture on ethics and I say, do what I said because I said so. And I don't expect them in every circumstance, some circumstances, but not in every circumstance to understand all of my reasoning for why it has to be. Sometimes I just need them to do what I say, and we'll get to the explanation when we have more time. Job has skipped a step. He does not understand the way the universe works, not because he's dumb, not because he's wicked, but because he's human. I am not God. And I don't know what I'm talking about. I can't. Every time we consider the question of evil, and I want to camp out here just for a second, stay with me. When we talk about why people suffer, what we end up asking is, why does God allow that to happen? And the implicit assumption in that question is, if I were God, I would not allow that to happen. What's the problem with that statement? It is actually impossible for you to know what you would do if you were God because you're not. You don't know what God knows. You don't have the capacity to psychoanalyze God. You don't have the capacity to stand in judgment over God and say, this is what he should have done, and that's what I would have done, because you cannot hold in our little brain all the things that God is aware of. The divine calculus for his ethical choices are simply beyond my capacity to reason with. And so from time to time, thank God for this, he takes the time to explain things to me because he's a good parent. And he really does want me to understand. But then sometimes he says, no, you don't get it. And I understand that you don't get it. What do we tell our kids sometimes? Maybe you'll get it when you're older. That's our cop-out for saying, I don't know what else to say. God says, he doesn't even say that to Job. Maybe you'll get it when you're older. He just says, who do you think you are? You seem to be giving me advice about how to run the universe. That's the way he says it, by the way. Who darkens counsel? What's counsel? He's not even complaining that Job is complaining. God is saying, did I catch you giving me advice just now? Were you telling me how the universe should be run? Who darkens counsel without knowledge? You don't know the answers to those questions. I am not God, and I just don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to those kinds of questions in the universe. Well, if I don't know the answers, that means I'm in a lot of trouble because God has some questions. In verse 3, he says, dress for action like a man. By the way, that's trouble. Dad ever tell you that? Stand up, young man, and look at me. Oh, something bad's about to happen. If I'm slouching on the couch, I was usually safe. But stand up, young man, and look at me. That means we're in trouble. Dress for action like a man. Or as we tell our boys, put your big boy pants on. And now we're going to have a conversation. And how's this going to go? I will question you, and you make it known to me. God seems to be making the very point we're making. That is, Job, I seem to have noticed you were giving me advice. The only thing scarier than God is God being sarcastic. And that's what happens for the next 3 chapters. Oh, Job, you'd like to give me advice? Fantastic, because I had all of these questions about how to run my universe, and maybe you can help. And Job, you can just see him kind of shrinking and cringing. Oh, what have I done? Because there's not any answers he can give to God. God and God alone has the right to ask the questions. And at the end of the day, we're not going to have answers for him. Because God is God and I am me. I don't get to demand anything from God as if we were equals. God can say, Ben, give me the answer to this. And he is within his right to demand an account of me. In fact, Scripture teaches us that at the end of all things, all people, every tongue will confess and give an account of what they have done to God. God has the right to demand of us an accounting of what he has done. You do not have the right to demand of God an accounting. And that's what Job has asked for. He says, I want an audit of the process. A mistake has been made. We need to correct it. God says, that's not how this works. We don't get to demand that. We can ask our questions. We can have our curiosities. We can express our frustrations, and God can take it. But when we start saying to God, oh, that you would just come down here and talk to me, I'd tell you how it is, that's when we get into trouble. So God's going to ask the questions. And what are the questions? You're not going to like the questions. Now, if you just read, I'm going to read the start of it. I would love to stand here for the next hour and read you the next couple of chapters lengthily and slowly. It would be wonderful, but I won't do that. I'll just pick the couple of verses here. 4-7. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched out the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. And that last bit, man, what a dig. Listen to what he says. He says, back when I made the universe, when I was doing it wrong, when I was doing such a magnificent job that the angels of heaven sang a song of exultation to the majesty of my creation, remind me what I did wrong there. I really need some assistance, Job. Oh, no, Job. He is in trouble. If you were to just ask one of these questions, Job would be in trouble. But God's on a roll. He's going to keep going for several chapters. Now, fair enough, when you read these questions as a modern person, I understand that some of them sound a little funny. They are based on an ancient understanding of the cosmos. He's talking to Job in the way that Job understood the universe because his point is that Job doesn't understand the universe. And so before you kind of get on your high horse and say, well, that's just ancient naivete and that's not how the universe works, that's the point. He's saying to Job, well, you're really clever. I mean, and some of the questions, where does the wind go when it's not blowing? Now, let me tell you, I have taught a meteorology class. I'm not any good at it, but I have taught it. If you ask your meteorology teacher, where does the wind go when it's not blowing? He's just going to look at you kind of funny and fail you, because that's not a good question even, right? It doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of modern understanding of science, of meteorology and weather and climate and things like that. You wouldn't ask a modern scientist, where does the wind go when it's not blowing? But Job, you know, that's his understanding of the world. You know, the wind, it comes and then it goes. And God says, okay, we're not going to talk about thermal updrafts and temperature differentials. Just tell me, where does the wind go when it's not blowing, Job? Tell me about that. And, of course, Job has nothing to say. And the whole set of chapter questions are like that. Job knows how to build a house. You put down a good foundation. Job, remind me, when I was doing such a terrible job of building the world, what did I build its foundations on? Where do the piers go down to? What's the bedrock? I can't recall. And, of course, Job has no answer for that. So don't get on your high horse and think, well, Job is just ignorant, because I'll tell you, we're not any smarter. Oh, yes, we are. We know all this stuff. I sat down just for fun, and I thought, what would be a modern Job? What would the questions sound like if these questions were asked today? And I thought of a couple that I'd love to, you know, go to university and let God ask these questions and see what happens. If this bores you too bad, I thought it was funny. Write a grand unified theory if you can. For the last several decades, physicists have been trying to figure out how to get quantum mechanics and relativity theory to play together. I was taught in school that both of them are absolutely true and they disagree. So I can imagine God in the whirlwind saying, Ben, you're a pretty good fella, a smart fella. Go fix that for us. Tell me how to make science work again because it's broken. Or where does human intellect come from? Explain that to me. Darwin was deeply concerned about this, by the way. If you go back and read his writings, Darwin believed that humans were sharing an ancestry with ancient primates and that our minds and brains were the result of a long process of biological descent from primates. But Darwin said, my concern is, if I asked a monkey a question, I wouldn't trust the answer. Why do I trust the answer when I give the answer? If I don't trust a monkey brain, I can't trust a human brain. That's Darwin speaking, not me. He was deeply concerned about that. That there's no reason to think that there should be any biological process to give rise to a useful human intellect that can do philosophy and write books and go to the moon. What evolutionary advantage is there to having a mind as powerful as ours in a world that all we have to do is survive? It doesn't make any sense. And Darwin said, yeah, I don't have an answer for that one. I think God would like to know. Or maybe, this is my favorite, and this will tickle some of you that are sci-fi fans, solve the Fermi paradox. I'll wait. Anybody know the Fermi paradox? This one's fun. Enrico Fermi was a physicist behind the Manhattan Project and a half dozen other important physics discoveries in the 20th century. And Fermi said one question that changed the world of astronomy, my background, forever. He said this, where is everybody? And what that question means is, we've been told that if you get the right chemicals in place, living things just pop out of the soup. Give it enough time on the right conditions, and living things pop out of the soup, and you get advanced civilization. Well, listen, we're not the only planet in the galaxy. And somebody did the math. A guy named Drake wrote an equation. It's terrible, but it works. And he did the equation, and he wrote it out, and he calculated, based on the things we know from evolution, there ought to be 300,000 advanced civilizations in our galaxy alone. Enrico Fermi says, hey, that's great. Where is everybody? We've only ever found us. And yet our science tells us the universe ought to be teeming with accidental life all over the place. Where'd everybody go? Maybe they just don't like us. Maybe we smell bad. Fermi had a really good question. My point is this, not that you should worry about these questions. My point is, don't think, well, I'm a modern man. I'm much smarter than Job, and I would answer everything perfectly. The point is that no matter how far we go in human development and intellect and ethics and physics and astronomy and biology and all the things we think we know, we hit horizons where we can't go to that next step easily. Where there are questions where the finite human mind hits a roadblock and says, I'm done. I have a book in my office by Robert Jastrow, who used to work for NASA. Brilliant, brilliant scientist. And he made this comment. He said, we did it. We climbed the peak. Scientists went up to the very top of human knowledge and we found preachers there waiting for us. And his comment was that at the end of the day, you get back to questions that we don't have answers for. And it's the same questions religious people have been asking, because we don't have the capacity to answer some of those questions. So lesson number four, and this is my grand summary of this section of Job, is this. And by the way, go home. You do yourself a favor. Go home today. Read chapter 38, chapter 39, chapter 40, chapter 41. It's a lovely read. If you like a riddle, read that section and see all the things that God says. But here's the summary of that section. It's fine to ask God questions. Watch your tone. You ever have this conversation with your kids? Where they say something that in and of itself is not a bad thing to say, but it's how they said it. Sometimes kids forget that they're the kids and not the parents. And they want to talk to parents like their peers. You know, Dad, if I was Dad, I'd do it like this. And that's essentially what Job has done. The problem isn't that Job is curious. The problem isn't that Job is upset. The problem isn't that Job is even complaining. God's big enough, he can handle it. Problem is, as you get towards the end of Job, Job kind of, in his anger and frustration, lets slip on his tone. And he starts to say things to God that sound like demands. He starts to say things that make it sound like, God, you and I are basically equals. Let's sit down and talk about this. And God says, that's not the way this works. At the end of the day, no matter what questions I have about human suffering, about how the world works and everything in it, I am not God. God is God and I am me. And I have to allow for the possibility that some things are going to escape my grasp. Scripture says it like this in what is ultimately my mother's favorite verse. My father, if you asked him a Bible question, would give you a 50-minute answer, regardless of the question, until you just walked away. My mother, however, had a much simpler response to any of my really difficult questions. She would say, Deuteronomy 29:29. I didn't have to look it up. I'd looked it up 100 times before. Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to the Lord our God. But the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. That was her way of saying, God's given us enough to worry about. Jesus says it like this, sufficient for the day is the evil thereof. Humans have plenty of things to worry about. Let me say it like this. Humans haven't figured out being human yet. We're not especially good at doing our part in the universe. Do you suppose we ought to figure out our part of the universe before we start telling God how to run his? The secret things belong to the Lord our God. But that which has been revealed belongs to us. We have a responsibility to it. At the end of the day, you have to either develop a trust in God or not. Either you think he is wise enough and powerful enough to keep his universe running, or you don't. But that's the choice you have to make. The name for that choice of trust in Scripture is the word faith. It's what the Bible defines as a conviction of things not seen, of knowledge that might just be too wonderful for me. It's the childlike acceptance that the parent knows what they're doing, even when it's not always clear to me. It's great to be curious. Don't forget who you are. Watch your tone. Come to God in faith and obedience, and treat him as the God of the universe, and you as his subject. Turn to him in faith and obedience, and we would love to help you do that. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If there's anything we can help you in that process, won't you come?